I read this morning that in a spirit of goodwill over the holidays, the United States has decided to take the vice presidents we've had and put them on programming jobs so that people can see what it's like to really program, and even vice presidents can program. In fact, they put them on their own Twitch channel. One of the vice presidents likes playing the bongo, right, he codes. So if you're interested, be sure to drop by and check out the algorithm. Hey, guys. You get this stuff for free. Imagine that. You don't have to pay a thing for these jokes.
I'd rather pay for something funny.
Well, you know, when you tell a really bad dad joke, you have to, like, do the fake laugh. Like, ha, ha, ha. So they understand that they're supposed to laugh. Okay, before we start, I am Daniel Arkham. This is Nerd Roundup. If you've never been to a Nerd Roundup before, you haven't missed a damn thing in your life, but we're happy you dropped by today. What is a Nerd Roundup? A Nerd Roundup is just a bunch of friends getting together end of each week, talking about news that nerds are interested in and kind of what we've been talking about. We talk about programming, project management, org change, anything that tech folks like to talk about. Why are we doing this? We're not doing this to sell anything or anything of that nature. I think a team that can relax and have fun is a team that can do damn near anything. The only way I know to show you how to do that is just perform it in front of you. So here we go. Today we have Scott Ambler, James Grinney, and Greg Young. Hey, guys.
Hey. Howdy, Dan.
Hey, Plaza. So, Scott, what you been up to this past week?
Oh, year-end working nonsense. So, you know, usual, everybody's in a panic to get stuff done. So, you know, crazy hours.
James, how about you?
Well, I decided not to do any more work this year, so that's working pretty good for me. I mean, not new work where I get paid anyway, you know, but...
Sleeping and then
later on in bed for a while today because I got my third COVID shot yesterday and thought there's a good excuse to lay around in bed. And so that worked.
Wait, you're only on your third? I thought we were at 17.
Yeah, you get a
I've been resisting it. You know, I figured I'm probably not that susceptible. I'm not in a high risk group, but we're going back to Chicago and the grandkids got it. And it's like, okay, what the hell?
I hear you get a free pandemic once you get the 7 shots.
And seeing them, I'll get jabbed.
Yeah. Mr. Greg.
Fair enough. Yeah.
What have you been doing?
I chose to get it. I'm just saying.
I'm just waiting for the next vaccine where what they do is they just inject you with COVID.
Well,
after you get this, you'll be immune for it.
Yes. One way or the other. Almost, looking good.
That's all right. Sign up for that one.
You're going to have some slight side effects for a few days, but afterwards.
If it's only a few days, yeah.
Yeah, how you feeling? Bam! How you feeling now? I feel bad. I'm bad. Oh, what have I been doing? I have been...
Yeah, man, what have you been doing?
I've been playing with Advent of Code. I just started yesterday. I got through on day 4 now. And if you haven't done Advent of Code, it's a honk of fun. I then took what I did on Advent of Code and turned that into a blog entry. I called F-Sharp Good and Bad. I have a picture of a cat on it. I've been doing things I consider useful. Nobody else in the universe probably does, but I enjoy doing these things.
I'm wondering about your comments in that code you just showed us.
Ah,
yeah, they're really helpful comments.
Well, hang on, let me see the back to the code.
Back to that code.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. System.collection.generic. I'm really glad to see that three times in a row. Actually, that's
those
important.
Are not comments. I don't think.
And then string. I'm really glad it's letting us know that that's a string. That's really. Yeah, those aren't comments.
These are comments. I don't know. What I did here was I set up a sort of a template for doing the coding problems, and this is just a scratch file. I just throw in it for every new day, and then fill it out as I go along.
All right.
Where did you guys go? Yeah, it's not, there's no actual programming going on here. It's more like crossword puzzles. Hang on, I've lost your video somehow. Oh, I know, because I've maximized the... There we go.
Here we are.
Yeah, it's like Sudoku for programmers, is what I consider it. And I think part of the fun of it is just taking your time and then deciding how much you want to clean up versus how much you just want to go to the next day. It's if you like crossword puzzles, fun. Yeah, I would. This is, matter of fact, that's purpose of my blog this morning was the fact that this is me thinking aloud using code. This is not code I would send to anybody or sell or anything like that. It's just like a diary. Guys are gone. And they're
off mic moment.
Yeah.
That's really important.
Getting us on a mic.
Yeah. So, yeah, the purpose of the blog, the purpose of the blog was to show that this is just me thinking aloud for doing a diary using F-Sharp. And that's okay. Programming can work both ways. It's not just you and your brain sending code to the universe. It can be setting things up in code and then realizing, hey, wait a minute, I need to do this other thing because I learned something.
You know what I've been waiting for most of my life at this point is when I can actually plug a cable into my head and use a REPL.
Okay, so you really need to consider like the going both way part of this because it's important. Yeah, humans are like inherently super illogical. And I think we really don't realize that until we program. Programming just takes whatever we consider symbols that are coherent. You stick them in some a sort of semi-math situation and realize, damn, I really don't understand what the hell I'm talking about.
We're not really very good at it, just saying.
I suck at coding, and it's one of the reasons I love it so much. It keeps me humble. It keeps me reminding me. As I get older, I'm actually worse at it. I think it makes me a better teacher because it's like I struggle more, so I don't assume so much.
I think I've mentioned it prior. In my family, I have an astrophysicist. And we've also got some friends of family who are mathematicians. And, you know, I'll be sitting working with them through some very complex mathematics. And they're like, mathematics, it's the hard.
And it probably is pretty hard, though, to be fair to them. But
I'm sure it is
harder than it looks. There's one thing I've learned, you know, working in different domains, it's always harder than you think.
The ones that tend to be the hardest are the ones where correctness is highly important.
Yeah.
One way of looking at this, I'm not plugging the book, but I go over it in my book, is that math is context-free. 1 + 1 = 2, and it doesn't mean anything in the real world whatsoever. It's nice that it means apples, but it's just a symbolic set that's coherent, computable system. It's a set of symbols. Human language is completely context-dependent. Nothing really means any damn thing. And so when you code, I call it applied philosophy because you're really having to take all this fuzzy human ideas and put it in something that's rigid and formal. And that can be painful for a lot of folks.
Well, but there are fuzzy languages.
Would you like to describe one of those?
Oh, fuzzy languages, they're more of a toy. They're for fun. So like, you don't have an if statement, you have a probabilistic if statement?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, and in fact, you can take rigid mathematical constructs, you can make fuzzy things out of it. We're going to get to this in a second, yes. Very much so. And when I talk about programming, I'm really talking about that sort of Haskell category theory programming, not what you did with Visual Basic in high school. It's the same thing, but it's much more loosely typed. When you really code, it catches you when you screw up. Again, they're gone.
And he's no clue. And the thing is, people watching the video now.
Wonder what happened to us. Yeah.
Well, no. Why are these guys talking to each other?
The gremlins are angry, but I think it's Canadians. I really think the problem here is Canadians.
There's got to be like
Canadians. A hockey game would have broken out by now.
But are they Newfie Canadians, French Canadians, or West Coast Canadians? Yeah, there's a massive difference here.
Yeah. Well, if it's the Newfie Canadians, then we would have been in the fuzzy land way, way earlier. But we'd all be drinking.
Well, no, we wouldn't have understood a damn word they were saying.
That's what I'm saying. It's fuzzy.
Take off, eh?
Beauty.
What you talking about,
I actually have relatives in Newfoundland, and I can't understand most of them.
The more beer I drink, the more sense he makes.
My relatives in Nova Scotia, who are much closer to Newfoundland than I am, they also struggle to understand some of their relatives in Newfoundland.
Yeah.
And they hear that accent on a far more regular basis than I do.
Cool country.
One of my good friends when I lived in Vancouver was a Newfie.
Yeah. Cool.
And he had been out of Newfoundland long enough that he was at least comprehensible when he wasn't drinking.
So like 10, 15 minutes a day. Yeah,
yeah, pretty much. But you know, once you got a few beers in him, like the Newfie came out.
Oh yeah, it's all over.
My first work day in Canada, the girl next to me stuck her head over the cube and said, "Don't mind me, I'm a frog." And I had no idea what the hell she was talking. Of course, she.
There's actually a term, frog, which is referring to the Quebecois.
Yes. I know that now. And I knew that at the time, but I just had never had somebody introduce himself as an animal before. I didn't.
Referring yeah. as what? What does frog mean?
Francophone.
French Canadian.
Oh, French Canadian. Okay.
Well, normally not French Canadian. It's normally just French.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, I knew that one. Definitely.
It originates French. Because you eat frog's legs.
Is that a hobby dang? Well, okay. They don't look like frogs. I know that.
Well, ah, you haven't met many, have you?
I met that one. She just very cute, actually. She looked nothing like a frog.
Oh, you have to be very careful in Quebec. That they are utterly beautiful until they hit about 36.
The frogs or the people? What do you mean? You get a 36-year-old frog, he's going to be ugly. I can tell you that right now.
Yeah, probably has some giant legs, though.
Well, see, I did not. The weird thing was I'd heard frog before, and I just thought it was a derogatory term. For her to self-identify, I was just, like, confused. It was uncomfortable. I did not call her. I didn't call nobody a frog. I was afraid of frogs for some time.
Yeah, that's...
Well, you know, you can call your own group by your derogatory term. I mean, there's a lot of precedent for that.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe she was baiting me. She was... Get the American dudes start calling people frogs, and then we can punch them in the head or something.
They would probably do that. They're going to punch you if they're with you directly anyway, probably.
Anybody's working with me over a day.
One thing you will find.
And then they'd apologize because they're Canadian.
Yeah.
One thing you will find quite funny is, let's say I'm bringing over one of my friends from Toronto.
Center of the universe.
To Quebec.
Hmm.
And now I'm out in a pub with them, and I'm talking with people, and je parle français fluemment, c'est pas un problème pour moi. And they don't speak French, and they will get pissed on. The American knows more French than you do.
Yeah. Yeah, but the smart Torontonians will just respond with, "Oh, I forgot to ask, do you guys take American money here?" And then suddenly smoke it again.
Well, when I was out there, the answer to that question was generally yes, we'd be happy to take it.
Yeah, and suddenly their ability to speak English improves dramatically.
Quebecois really kind of French. I'm kidding. French rejects. So we have the Cajuns who are like rejects from those guys. The double rejects.
Yep.
Well, it's just, you know. Anyways,
although the Quebecois did something quite interesting in return, though. You know, the Quebecois rejected the church.
The French people got really mad at that. Something about the Reign of Terror, I believe, is a big deal.
Yeah, the Quebecers, like when they came over, for a large part, rejected the church back in Europe.
Yeah,
and they lived as heathens.
You know, people don't realize this. We talk about people coming to the new country for religious freedom. Most of the time, it meant freedom to be assholes. Puritans wanted to outlaw Christmas. They had this big set of rules, and the French, it was not freedom to get along with everybody. And they're gone again. Now on to weather. Thousands die in tsunami. Hey, how about those Dodgers?
We're come back.
So, guys, what I've decided to do here is you guys just keep talking. I will keep talking. Greg, the first article was holograms. Very, very cool hologram technology. I have time to scan that. Greg put in a, and here's how it works. Even more cool. This is a We're talking about true 3D light field holography, which would be freaking awesome. But Greg has an article, so I want to cue this up before we completely die.
Different types of holograms, huh?
Yeah, that's really cool stuff. They're talking about true holograms, and my question is, if you have a true hologram, it looks like a person, what would you do with that? Like, put it in the corner of your room, or how would you see? Change this TV into more like a play? Would you have like little tiny people running around?
And that's where I think we're going to end up with a lot of production coming forward. Is it will actually be you have a device that's, and then two people walking around.
You're like seeing a play, pretty much so.
Well, if it was.
Hey, you know what they say? It's the old new thing.
Yeah, it's going to change a lot of stuff, I think. It's going to be weird. Yeah.
It's going to be hard to do, but. Pixels?
Oh, they're pushing a ton of pixels. You can be sure of that.
They compared it to 2K, 4K, 8K TVs, and
well, they use a
lot of pixels.
Cake. It's a birthday cake configuration, so they just stack somehow or another. Display on top of John. We're having meeting from hell today, so if it drops a bunch of times, just continue talking to yourself or whatever. It's okay.
Making fun of Dan is what really happens. But
You need to use Zoom. It works. Just saying.
I'd like to use Discord. I was on Discord this past week. It was pretty cool. So Greg has an
article. But the hologram thing.
It might not work from Daniel's though, because he's in the middle of nowhere.
Hey, we got all kinds of tubes out here. We got all kinds of stuff we can do to the net stuff.
You got vacuum tubes, did you say? Okay, great.
Yeah, that's what the whole you house was on.
All good.
Greg.
Explain,
please, the analog computers.
Yes, so basically the very core of things is instead of running with capacitors, you're essentially running with resistors. And it's basically bringing everything more to an analog model. Like it's kind of cool. So one of the great quotes in here is in resistive memory, you do not need to translate to digital or binary. You can remain in the analog domain.
It's a potato. It's a potato. It's a tomato. It's a tomato. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be a lot of resistors to calibrate? Holy cow.
Well, you'd use a computer for that.
Start getting really crazy with this is when I say this is going to make total sense because it's analog, is what they've been focusing this on is dealing with neural networks.
Oh, yeah.
Where I don't necessarily want a perfect signal.
I have been auditing an MIT course on neural cognition. I've decided that you guys are gone again. And the brain be a very, very complicated thing. More like a plant. Ready to come back? I'd like to sing you the song of my people. Over the wind.
Make lots of them and throw some away for recycling back into new ones than to actually make them properly.
So yeah,
the company I used to work for used to make a device to trim lasers. So you'd make them physically a little too big and then you would hone them into exactly what you needed them to be electrically within your tolerances. Cool. Laser trimming.
Anybody heard anything about the MIMSister?
Should do that with software features. Sorry, I was just saying we should do that with software features.
Laser trimming.
Can we use real lasers that actually cut things?
We can use any damn.
This sounds like a fantastic idea.
This is on a very small scale. This was back 30, 40 years ago.
That feature was horrific. You lose a finger.
Oh, that kind of cutting. I wasn't thinking of that. Maybe the keyboard.
So I've been auditing this MIT course on neurocognition, and after about seven or eight lectures, holy shit, the brain is complicated. Oh my God.
You mean it's not just a sigmoid function?
We're nowhere near, but what we think of neural nets is just not even close.
Not even. Yeah, I remember something like a month ago. Oh, speaking of, I think I might have mentioned some other show. But, you know, my wife's doing a crossword puzzle. And she, you know, the clue was, you know, unit of capacitance or something like that. And I immediately blurted out the wrong answer, but then immediately followed up with, you know, farad. So I forget what I might have said ohm first or something, but then I said, you know, farad or something like that. And then I just stopped and said, because I was doing something else. You know, I'm not doing the, you know, I'm not thinking about electrical engineering, you know, and to your point, like, I don't know, could a computer do that? I mean, to me, how does that work in your brain? To dredge something up that I probably learned back at Ohio State. I don't do that work for a living, right? When was the last time I cared about the units of capacitance?
Each
but it was somehow.
Each neuron can have tens of thousands of connections, and that's not counting the synapses where it reaches out.
One neuron
is probably more complicated than some of our nets.
So Owen and Faraday were probably sharing a bunch of connections.
If you're looking for some interesting work on this, what you want to look up for research papers is associative memory.
Yeah, it sounds like what it was somehow.
Yeah, that sounds like what this is.
Yeah. But still,
there's been a lot of research into this. So you generally start off with, let's just call it a tree or a graph. And basically, I have weights between things. So I have the color blue and sky as two concepts and a link between them that has a weight associated to it. Now, I might have another link from sky to airplane with a weight associated to it. So now when I see blue sky and it's in context of an airplane, we have an idea what people are talking about.
But be aware,
probably the sky is not sad.
Yes, no, right see, now. No, but you see, you're coming from the outside of the brain looking in, and that's we've been doing that for hundreds of years now. It's all we got. But for instance, we talk about different parts of the brain, like speech and memory or whatever. That's not always true. It's not as if they're little modules that do things. You can be born with half a brain, like I probably was, and still like look pretty functional. So your brain is not some modular system of things with weighted connections. It's just that system of modeling works out kind of close to what we do.
Right. That's what we got. Yeah, it's cool.
Well, I would agree. Really interesting thing about that model is that it's massively scalable.
Yeah, but nowhere near a brain. It's, you know, it is mass for us. 17 is a pretty big number for me, but not for the neuron. Yeah, I can take my shoes off once we get past 10. Okay, so holograms. Next topic is conferences. I talked to my wife yesterday. She says, you know, you should make a list of conferences you'd like to talk at or go to. And I'm like, holy cow, is there such a thing? And it turns out there's a bazillion of these things. There's a product management, there's project management, there's agile, there's testing. And so my question to you guys is, do you have any lists you use? And if you do, what are the cool conferences you would recommend?
There's none on Antarctica.
There is one going to the North Pole. I've mentioned it before. I've mentioned it before. There is one going to the North Pole.
A conference.
What, a Santa thing? Or?
You got a cruise ship?
No.
Yes. Santa product management.
Plants with dogs.
And Soviet Union. Santa.
Get the Euro from. Through that. Yes. Well, remember there used to be the geek cruises. Did any of you geek on those years ago? And it was a cruise ship. You know, they did Hawaii and Alaska and a couple others, but it was great. And there were solid.
There's only one problem I had with the cruise conferences. Most of the sessions were complete rubbish, but the discussions afterwards were great.
Oh,
well, we can change
the geek cruises. They at least the ones I went to, they nailed it. They had an amazing Java one back in the day, and there were solid talks.
What tended to happen was, and I've seen this at many, many conferences. Even the speakers were out at 3 o'clock in the morning the night before their talk. But
isn't
there
is
great
fire?
Discussion with everybody at 3 o'clock in the morning before their talk.
My first year going to Agile, I think it was 2008 or 2009. I go to a session and the guys came in and laid down on the table. We're like, oh man, what a night! it was just them moaning. And of course, we kind of took over, but I was like, wow.
I will not say who the speaker was, but at one of the conferences I was involved with. The speaker had not gone to bed yet. And was up for their talk, and they did their talk, and it's like I'm having a chat with them afterwards going, you realize you were slurring your words, right? But the talk actually went over well. Like, what he said was quite good.
No, that's twice on that.
He was slurring his words a bit, but he was okay.
Speaking of Java, a good friend of mine, Heinz Kabitz, who's a super Java expert, he has been blogging for like 20-some years. He lives in Crete now, and he has not yet taught a class on, I think, Antarctica, and I suggested, oh, well, we could do a cruise down there, and to your point, Scott, he wasn't interested, so we could... We could get on that continent. I mean, it's kind of expensive to get down there, but
John,
anyway, I thought it was
I'm your Huckleberry.
So, James, the last time I was up to see you and Bob, I think you were talking about some conference in Europe. It was like four or five letters, like CVVT or Q. It was a weird name for it. It looked really, really geeky. Does that ring a bell?
Agile on the beach, or oh no, the.
It was like
ACCU. And I had to remember it because I made up an acronym for it. It wasn't that the organizers weren't so happy about my makeup, but it was Aging C and C++ Users.
Oh my God.
But Yarny was there, and then who's the guy from Big Bank, Lakos, which he has a reputation for making sure that everybody parties way too much.
Oh, goodness.
And but that was in Bristol. Really nice conference to go to. I don't know if they're doing it anymore, but England's kind of shut down, so.
I got into coaching, and I had this, like, dove in, like, coaching, like, 10 or 20 teams at a time. There's this huge company. And I went from being a technical PM to, like, here you are. And I had not really read any damn thing about Agile story points. I just kind of dove in because I knew how to deliver stuff. And so I got to speak that year at the conference. And I walk in, it was about non-standard teams. And I walk in, I said, you know, I really haven't read any books about Agile. And you could like hear like the groans all through. Everybody's like, oh. I'm like, whoops. Don't say that again. There's a bad thing.
That was a joke.
Yeah, just
who's read those?
They were probably all authors coming in to see, you know, the competition looked like.
I don't have a CSM.
The funny thing with most of USM. The Agile books is you could summarize them down to a couple chapters.
You don't want to know my opinion on that because it's. I think there's a word, pablum, I think it covers a lot of. It just happens to be esoteric enough most people won't follow. But
what I particularly love are the Agile books that start becoming 400 to 500 pages because they've brought in all kinds of formal process to Agile.
Yeah, I really struggled with my first book on just software backlogs because I was trying to do what everybody else has done, and that is try to physically model how you make stuff people want. And the weird thing is we are born doing, we can do this at age two, but somehow when we become programmers, we start trying to model this thing. It's really an exercise in AI. This is a neural net thing. And you just, there's
I'm trying to remember what book it was.
And this is the time the alien overlords picked to take over the Earth. We all ran screaming into the night. It's odd. Really weird. You know, my videos froze up as well.
Oil and natural gas.
There was actually a reasonable argument some time ago in the Agile community about how much work should be.
You know when something's sufficient, and the challenge is that there's factors, you know, if you actually dig into it, there's factors that push you into towards more detail early on, but there's also factors that push you towards less detail early on, and many of them are qualitative in nature, so it gets down to it depends, and you're going to have to make an experience-based decision, which then blows everybody's minds when they're looking predictable.
So how much per day do you normally charge to come in and make that decision for them?
I'm getting $5 a day.
Anywhere from $2,000 to $4,000. Yeah, a lot of it to me is it's risk mitigation. And it's if you don't understand what risk you're trying to mitigate by doing more, then you're just doing more. And a lot of times siloed organizations, you have someone who does UX and have somebody who does the business requirement document, you'll get access because that's what they do for a living. They don't do the holistic delivering value. You ask a bricklayer, they're going to lay bricks. So I think it's...
Yeah, I think the risk mitigation is a key concept there. You know, so we've got this idea and it goes from here to there. And what are those little things? How can we see if we're insane for even trying this and hooking all the little pieces together, you know, building that skeletal slice through...
How do we maximize
looking at the risks?
I used to tell people I'm process agnostic. If you want to bring in the CMM book or the Safe book or the DA book, from you bring whatever you want into the team.
No. That Safe book hurts when you get it.
No. But we're all going to dynamically tailor what we do. So you can bring the book in and we can just say, hey, these are pretty cool topics. We're not doing this. But the reason you can bring it in is not because I'm bullshitting you. It's because it's risk management. These are good ideas. Maybe this is a big risk we need to consider. And so, yeah, please bring in more and more stuff. It's good.
The other side of this, and I know Scott's dealt a lot with this, is it's very different when we're talking about 200 people versus 15 people.
Yeah.
Well, but it's also, how risky, how risky is it? Like, you know, if I'm putting together a web page, who cares? If I'm building medical software, I should probably be reasonably concerned. So that's the fundamental challenge. But it's not really risk mitigation. It is when you look at it from the point of view of a single risk. But the problem is when I mitigate risk A, when I do something to mitigate risk A, or at least to reduce risk A, suddenly I'm turning up the lever on risk B. And so then it ends up being a portfolio of risks. And what can I live with, and what knobs can I twist basically to get it to some sort of risk profile-y thing that I can live with?
Just as a random thought, because we used to do this in a financial company. So dealing with technical debt, we used to issue debentures.
Yeah, cool.
Is there a way that we could do the same thing with risks in terms of building a portfolio?
I've played with this, and the answer is yes, you can do it, but it's a tad onerous because you've got maintenance issues and stuff like that. Because the thing is, everything's in you get this horrendous number of relationships between the risks. Because, you know, as you go out in, you know, what concerns am I interested in, then everything I, you know, every knob, how many knobs have I got? Every time I twist a knob, it affects something else. I twist this, it affects something else. See, it's, you know, it's just this complex system and it blows.
Yeah, organizations learn from the bottom up. They tend to want to control from the top down. And so if you're not careful, you end up doing this, who can think of risks and make them sound really scary game. And that can lead you down to a lot of process. You don't.
Yeah. Well, and it's not, and the thing is, it's the risks are there, right? Like this is, so in DA, we help you make choices between strategies basically. And underneath all, so this is what's happening on the surface, but in behind all this, you really are fiddling around with risks and if we're mitigating risks or exasperating risks, depending on what's going on. Both actually. So what happens is, so when you start looking at the details just spin out of control on you. So because of the nature of the beast.
And when you address one risk, it likely leads you to new risks.
Well, that's it, right? And they're all connected, and they all
you can see so many in the beginning, and then as you start to take it apart and get new ideas of how to solve that problem, then you're addressing new things. You know, if we'd done it all before, it'd be pretty easy to say how long it's going to take, but usually you're not doing it the same
thing. I will come back to this as, could I model this set of risks as a portfolio?
Yeah.
And then basically, as we're changing things, this is the same as me changing my portfolio in a trading aspect.
That's exactly, that is exactly what it is.
You're describing a PMO.
Yeah,
I think Greg, the one of the aspects is consider some of those as NF, non-functional requirements. If there's things for compliance, if there's goofy things that often are dealt with either architecturally or process-wise, 5 years later nobody remembers why the hell we designed it like this or what's this blocking thing in our damn process, and you forgot about it because nobody wrote down those. Like I always use the wiki, for example, for all the stuff that you can't divine by looking at the code. And these are classic examples. If there are huge drivers that cause me to do something architecturally for performance or for compliance or whatever it is, call me verbose. I'm not anti-documentation. I probably write more wiki pages than most on Teams. And that's how I've handled it. Could it be more, you could probably build a taxonomy and probably build a tool to do that, but.
This is actually related to the neural net question, because what Greg was asking, can you model like this complex interaction of hundreds of people trying to deliver a product to market, deliver value, manage risk? And the answer is sure, you can model a neural net the same way. And what you're really trying to do is get a good enough model that you can sort of make decisions about risk with. And that's kind
no,
of
No. I don't want to make that decision come out. I want probabilities to come out.
Yeah. You want to see the effects of things, right? You want to simulate the effects of things, right? Because I'm thinking about making this decision. Wonder what'll happen. And
if I do this here, what happens throughout the rest of this graph?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And the problem is there's so many. It's depending on the level of detail you go down to, because it's not useful until you go down to a reasonably granular level. But by going down to a reasonably granular level, it gets exponentially crappy.
I've been in on a lot of these things, guys, and you get to business domain and architectural drivers very, very quickly. You can do abstract taxonomy, but no, at some point there's some real architecture happening in the background and some shifting business landscape you're having to deal with. And so it's a mess. You can do that, but it's a messy process.
It is, yeah.
And how do you make some of your decisions reversible?
Yeah, right, well, so and this is a big part of things.
Yeah, I speak in palindromes. Way to make your business decision reversible. Palindrome words spelled the same way forward. Next article was going to be about chickens. And done.
It's forward. This is actually like a really good metric of them. I'm completely unsure how we define it, but providing we can, this would be a great metric of them.
Well, it gets back to Scott's talking. You know, a lot of it is qualitative and subjective, and it's experience about what's going to bite me in the ass. Do I need to worry about a million hits per second before I'm even sure that anybody gives a crap about my product? No. Is that going to get there someday? Yes. Do I need? Yeah. So, you know, as an engineer, we learned long ago to treat things, you know, systems thinking, holistic, especially aerospace. You know, you wiggle one part of the, you want to go faster? Okay, well, we're going to not go as far or carry less bombs, right? You can't just wiggle one part. So for me, it's a natural, you know, always building that mental model, always building those, that system view and documenting it with UML and other things. But to other people, I'm not sure if that resonates, the whole risk.
Yeah, just to underline that, you're modeling this on a running system. So you don't build one model to do them all. Having said that, there are patterns of behavior. Fine. But you're never, ever going to nail. If you could nail how a company delivers a product, a robot would be doing that. They wouldn't be a
company. Things, risks are often really personal. It's like, what does your team not know about? Rather than, you know, what's not knowable. A lot of things are knowable. Right. And then if you don't have the skill on a team to do such a thing, and I remember, you know, I've got a recent memory of one of these, and we're trying to figure out how to work these IoT radios into a system, and, you know, we don't know anything about it. And so there's a risk. You got to go and address right away. Otherwise, you're finding out that you're crazy for even doing anything. Or.
And James, you're giving me flashbacks to Broad Vision.
To what?
Broad Vision.
Yeah. And it's usually the unsaid risks that, like, or the risks that you really, you know of, but you can't really put down on paper. It's like, I was working with a government agency a while ago, and, you know, they have a very serious risk that the politicians make decisions, and which, you know, isn't the greatest thing to do. So they're working, and they know, you know, what's going to happen. You know, it's not going to be ideal. But you can't possibly put that into your risk log. You can't, like, other than, you know, it's going to happen, you know, you really can't talk about it, because that's just not a very good career move for you.
So did you come up with an acronym? Like, it's the PW feature. What's that?
That sort of thing happens, but it's also, you know, or you inherently know you've got a risk that if you lose some of your better people, you know, or some of your people on the team, you've got a serious problem, and you know, Bob over here is an unhappy camper, but you're never gonna, you know, explicitly that kind say of risk, it.
Yeah. One of the coolest things I've seen working with programs was when I attended my first potentially shippable increment meeting for SAFE. And I know people hate SAFE, but this is basically a program level planning session where we had 10 to 20 different teams. You got 100 people in there. God damn. And the thing is that with that many people playing at one time, you end up seeing all these connections that nobody's able to try. So talk to management beforehand, their idea, what it was, and they're completely different.
A lot of times, you really do end up downstream without people knowing how you got here, because there's never those risks.
It looks like the hat is changing.
Every time it drops, I'm putting my hat on.
Santa.
You going for Santa's the gray
back. The pointy top is what you want. I apologize, guys. James has to leave at 10 till, so I propose that we try to push forward another 5 minutes or so. And
go, keep going. Don't worry about me. But yeah, I wanted to talk. This planets one is an interesting one.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's part of the plot to make sure there's no American named planets, and trying to get back to having some planets named by Americans.
I will die on this hill. Pluto is a planet, damn it. Okay.
I know. Pluto is a planet. I mean, what's Percival Lowell doing?
There was an article by an astronomer. You know, Pluto died, and I was the one that killed him. This was a real article. Yeah.
Let's see how big of a parade.
An article with this one.
And they're gone.
Churn.
Well, what's the other one? Like Mach-a-Mach or something like that? Like, I literally have no idea how to pronounce it. It's written as make. Which sounds like something I would be typing if I had an absolutely horrific job. Make.
Yeah, I think we should have 30 or 40 planets. I don't see the argument where that's a bad idea.
Well, if you're a grade school student has to memorize all these things, that's
That might be a little excessive.
The astrologer.
We'll give them names that were useful for other things as well. So, like, we'll name one of them Socrates. We'll name one of them Plato instead of Pluto.
Or actually not memorizing them, maybe you could memorize the ones that are visible, and then the other ones, what are the principles behind deciding if something is a planet, might be an interesting thing to learn instead. Like this article.
Oh, come on. With our advances in technology, within 500 years, you'll be able to like go to a fair and shoot a BB gun at one.
I'm sure you could. You can do that right now. It's just whether you're hitting.
It wouldn't go very far.
Yeah, you're not going to hit it.
Yeah, you can't actually shoot the damn thing. You could shoot at it.
Okay, so we're gonna no, because you wouldn't be shooting at it. What? You need to shoot to where it's going to be.
Yeah.
It's like duck hunting. Detail. Come on, you play duck hunt on Nintendo. Well, you don't shoot where the duck is.
Apollo, they did this, right?
Yeah.
Unless the duck is just sitting on the ground, but
here's an interesting little known fact, apparently. Did you know on the Nintendo, in the Duck Hunt game, the second controller controlled the duck?
It does, yes.
Oh, wow.
That greatly makes that game more playable.
Yeah, and complicated, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so does standing more than 3 inches away from the screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, the kids.
Wasn't the way that played that was the screen flashed and it was the photoreceptor in the gun. So it wasn't you shooting the screen, it was the photoreceptor seeing the screen flash.
Yeah.
That would make sense.
Probably watching the retrace.
So you were talking about a BB shooting to the planet. Interestingly enough, not only on surface ships, but really advanced projectiles, you know, from howitzers. And the controls for the algorithms. They actually, you know, account for the rotation of the Earth.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Not just the wind. Not like crazy stuff like that.
Sniper rifles. Yeah, shoot over a mile or two. They have to do Coriolis forces.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a long time, and if you know, it's like, oh yeah, if I have my camera open at night, the stars are moving even in 30 seconds.
So you've got to at least know about this.
So did you know that they actually sell four telescopes, and they're not that expensive, but this might be something that even one of us might buy, where it's basically a stand you put your telescope on, and it will move to match the Earth's orbit based on where you are.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
They're with most scopes now, actually, they're part of most scopes. You have to align with the North Star.
Yep.
So this next article, I'm not sure we get there because it's related to
John. You need to pull her off.
This is a Canadian who built a giant cannon.
Yeah,
shoot
for Iraq
into orbit, and he was killed by the Mossad, the Israelis. So it's just a hell of a story involving Canadians, like big gun satellites, got everything you want.
Oh, because he was building one of these things for
the
Iranians, right?
Yeah, it was either for Iraq or for the Iranians, like one of the countries that
Iraq
with was Iraq. Okay, yeah, they had an issue with Israel, and the Israelis didn't appreciate the big gun that he was making, and
it was an intercontinental cannon was what it was, and he could build one. It's possible to build one.
I wonder,
the Germans have World War II.
I'm talking about a 3,000 mile shot with a cannon.
That's a little longer.
And hit the target.
If you can do that, then you can put a booster on and you've got satellites. It's a perfectly possible thing to do. It's just the Israelis did not want like this kind of gun kind of going out into the world.
For some reason, they didn't appreciate the concept.
Right, the pure physics. Yeah.
The physics is awesome. Yeah, getting killed by the side.
Science of it at all.
They shot him
fine. Maybe as a child, he saw the movie A Trip to the Moon, where they basically shoot a big bullet at the moon, right?
Yeah.
One of the problems he had was getting the right powder, because it was such a huge charge, projectile would leave the cannon before it was finished, the powder was finished burning. So he had to move to a solid projectile charge, which made things quite dangerous, but it was not, it was very easy to do. As a matter of fact, they just shut him down with a gun.
It's a pretty vulnerable weapon, because it's going to just be sitting in one place, the one he was building, you know, so.
But I'm sure
if you got nice to use it a couple of times.
It's like $3,000 a shot. Wouldn't it be nice for $3,000 to put something in orbit? God, that would be awesome.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, what, and people have done this, right? You build the, you know, you get the prototype going, and then you improve on it, and you put it on a train or something, and then you can start moving around.
Oh, wait, no, nothing like this ever existed, and there's never been anything named Big Bertha ever.
Never.
Hey, nerds, I gotta go.
All right, see you, James. Have a good one. Thanks for coming by. See you, James. What's next? This was the AI story. Guys are...
Yeah, it'd be a fun toy. Oh, here we go.
Hey, guys.
I think the number of hats Daniel goes through is the number of chunks of video he's...
Yeah, that I could spot the video easier. Oh, that was a sombrero.
Exactly. Right.
I appreciate you. I'm really sorry. This is the worst we've ever had with this show. It just amazes me that it's dropping so much. I blame the education system, but it is.
So while these were cannons, that the other thing about chickens and aircraft aircraft engine testing, yeah, that was something I remember down at GE in Cincinnati. That's a cool.
Yes,
we did crazy testing with cruise boats.
Scott, we had the Canadian chicken cannon earlier. We didn't talk about it, but Canadians and big cannons.
Putting birds through engines generally doesn't work out well. Work well for the bird.
Largest cannon in the world is the Canadian chicken.
The reason they did the frozen birds is because you might have a bird that gets dragged up, then freezes, and then goes through.
It falls down, yeah.
I was just assuming it's easier to shoot a frozen hard projectile than a soft one.
I was referring specifically to engine testing. Use both fresh and frozen birds.
Yeah.
The Canadians have the largest chicken cannon in the world. 15 inches, I think.
That would be a turkey.
Yeah. There used to be a comedian called Super Dave, and every week he had the chicken cannon gag. Check him out on YouTube. It's really corny, but funny.
Also, this check story, that out. Talking cats. It turns out there's this whole genre of talking animals on TikTok and the internet. I did not know this was a thing. So if you're interested in this, there's a bunch of links here to talk. Most of them are dogs, but there are some cats. And by talking, I mean they push little buttons to say what they want. It's cute. It's cat.
Okay, I had to look this up, Scott, but it appears to exist.
Super Dave, yeah.
No. There appears to be a cod cannon in Newfoundland.
Oh, a cod cannon?
Fish cannon? Oh, my God.
That would smell, but
could lead to a war. Where
these days?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully, it's not a cod piece cannon.
Dang, new fish with your fishes. That's my Bernie Sanders, I think.
But a cod cannon might be the most newfie thing ever.
Yeah.
If it was powered by beers, it would be the ultimate.
And does it like you know, batter and fry it as it's going out? See,
this is the idea we had last week.
That would be impressive, but I think we're waiting on the Brits to make that work.
Big enough cannon, you could cook the food as it goes through the arc.
Yeah, and deliver it.
Yeah, oh yeah, this is like startup central.
Forget this drone nonsense. You can just shoot your fish and chip cannon at
it's intercontinental. You can deliver food anywhere on the East Coast.
Yeah. What could go wrong?
What could go wrong? Like the WKRP turkey drop.
Yeah.
I'm guessing curry GPS might not be the most popular dish.
I would want an entire turkey. The baked potato, maybe. I don't know. It's going to be a hard sell. So the Navy is getting patents on anti-gravity and fusion devices. And this has been going for about a year, and if I can believe in Santa Claus, golly dang it, I can believe the Navy is developing anti-gravity. I cannot
believe this, because I can assure you that the Air Force would be right there saying, no, you cannot do this. Right. This is our jurisdiction.
We did this already.
Space Force now? Wouldn't it be their jurisdiction? But anyway.
I don't know. I still say it's a USS, you know, Starship Enterprise. That's not an Air Force designation. That's a Navy designation. Just saying.
Best bet.
Star Trek has.
This is a total head fake and bullshit thing by the Navy just to try to get other powers to invest. That's the best expert guess we got. I don't know.
Oh, that would be funny.
200 patents.
What's hilarious is that if we actually had anti-gravity technology, that would revolutionize our understanding of physics in so many ways that we would probably also have interstellar travel. We would probably also have...
Yeah.
Like, they're real assholes if they've been hiding this.
Hey, I'm going to write an angry letter. I can tell you that right now.
You'd have to do a heck of a break.
You're going to need to put on your blonde wig and change your name before you do.
This has got an EM flux detector. We all know that the flux is a very important part of any sort of time machine.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as long as you get 1.21 gigawatts, you're good to go.
I mean, they've obviously built something. They have, like I said, 200 patents. The head of Naval Research says that other powers are also working on this. It's important for the Navy to get patents in this area. For no other reason, just to not be locked out of it by other powers.
Oh, yeah, I have no doubt that the U.S. military respects other countries' patents.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, them putting what they actually have into a patent in order to hide it makes total sense.
Well, yeah. There is a secret patent system, I think.
A good strategy.
I don't know. I think in the Santa sleigh would be sort of the next thing to do here, because there's some debate over exactly how that works.
Yeah. Well, I gotta admit though, I think it.
In a minute.
And I'm a bit younger than at least two of you. But I watch back in the 1950s, 1960s, which was before I was born, when they had the U.S. military coming on, doing NORAD with Santa coming across. And you know what? That was fucking cool.
It was, yeah. They still do stuff like that.
That is cool. If they did it way back then, that's really awesome. Yeah. Who knows? Maybe I was watching when I was a kid. And I just didn't know that. Although, no, we didn't. No, we didn't have a TV till I was in second grade. So
we've been watching Christmas movies for the last week or so. And Santa's like always falling off a roof. He's getting sad and not doing Christmas. He's got the elves rebelling against him. That Santa guy's like nothing but bad luck every time. There's a Christmas that they're gonna. It's in danger, and Santa's got problems.
I'm trying to remember the name of the movie, but they did a more realistic Santa movie where the elves were actually slaves.
The elves were slaves?
Was it the Kurt Russell movie?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a new Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn Christmas movie on Netflix. And the elves, the elf background is...
a little sketchy.
Very realistic. But, yeah.
Christmas Chronicles, also a Kurt Russell movie with Santa. Yeah. Excellent movie. Most awesome. They did a sequel. It sucked a lot. But Christmas Chronicles, if you want a happy one. What's the name of this?
Actually, wait. I think it's South Park that did it.
Too. Yeah, that was the sequel.
Wait, no. It wasn't South Park. It was... wasn't The Simpsons... It was Futurama.
Mike Judge doing something else.
Because they had the robotic Santa.
Oh, I remember a picture of that, I think.
An evil robot Santa ran a series of slaves who...
Yeah.
Cool Runnings, a great Norwegian film. They dig up a Santa who turns out to be like a horrible monster.
I'm not sure that's quite the right film there.
These are terrible ideas. Santa's
Cool Runnings was the Jamaican...
That's like the Jamaican bobsledding team or something. Well,
Santa was there, too. You just didn't have a big... It was Rare Exports. I'm sorry. I get Santa... The Norwegians, Jamaicans, they're very similar cultures.
Oh. Yeah. Everybody gets confused.
One of the things I've learned from Netflix is if you go to Europe and, like, hang out anywhere in Scandinavia or Germany, they got all kinds of freaking problems. They got, like, time caves, they got monsters... It's just no good. You don't want to do that.
Yeah, there you go. There he is.
Okay, guys, let me segue off here and do the goodbye, and then I'll come back and commiserate and drink heavily. Okay, hang on a second. Yeah.
Are you bringing the whiskey?
Yes, it's internet whiskey, much as you want. Okay, so you've wasted yet another hour of your time, along with my friends here, and I'm very sorry for the internet performance. But you've been watching Nerd Roundup. I'm Daniel Markham. I have a site. I have a book. I juggle, I tell stories, and I whistle and do karaoke. Please come by again, and I will see you on the internet.